Good morning. Glad to be here with you this morning and share about hummingbirds. Hummingbird superlatives. The theme this weekend is all creatures great and small. So hummingbirds are at once small, they're tiny, but they're also great in many ways. So today we want to stand in awe of God the Creator as we fly into hummingbird superlatives. Now, what superlatives about hummingbirds can you think of? What does superlative mean? Someone tell me what superlative means. Hello? All right, exceeding others. That's pretty good, yeah. And that's a real good. In fact, when I looked in the dictionary, it said, of the highest kind, above all others. So right there you have it, exceeding others. So yes, these are ways in which hummingbirds exceed other birds, and they're of the highest kind. So we want to focus more on the design elements today, especially that indicate God's amazing design. Now, back to my question, what are some superlatives? In what ways are hummingbirds above other kinds, then? Can you think of anything like that?
Their size.
All right. Size. That's one of the things I have here. You're right. What else?
Agility.
Good.
The iridescent feathers.
All right. The iridescent feathers. All good. All right. Speed of their wings. That's all related to their, I class that under flight, that agile and their wing speed and all that. We'll talk about that under flight. Anything else? That's all good. You got nailed a bunch.
Tiny.
All right, the size again. Yes, right. They're tiny.
They're tiny nests and eggs.
All right.
Size of their feet.
So these are. I'm thinking more general terms here now, but where do hummingbirds live? We'll talk about that a little. How many kinds are there? And another thing that I especially want to kind of major on is, and this is, I think, probably the most important thing, is, because we tend to look on the outside and say, wow, that's so neat. But then, what about the inside? So that's what I hope to show you today is the inside. I mean, other birds aren't almost a hummingbird. I mean, we were in Hawaii, there was a lady at a farmer's market, and she said about another bird that looks similar to a hummingbird, it's almost a hummingbird. And I thought in my mind, no, it's not. A hummingbird is specially created, designed. It has special features inside that no other bird has, and they can't touch it. So we look at that. So we want to fly into these. All right, so superlative. And I want to start with beauty because that's kind of the thing we think of most. Is it coming through okay? The mic? All right. The picture in the front, that's one I downloaded. It's a painting from the 1800s, so it's kind of maybe not totally realistic, but it's interesting. This is one I got. I asked Kevin Shank if he has any good photos, and he has lots. So he sent me one here just to show some of the variety. These would all be, you know, like the local hummingbirds. And this is a compilation, like he put several birds in one photo there. And so we want to think about beauty because this is often what comes first to our minds when we're talking about hummingbirds. And how about that fella? Fiery-throated hummingbird. It's just amazing. It's just incredible. And then, I mean, I got a bunch more on here. Many of the hummingbirds are named after jewels because they're called little jewel birds. Because their colors are similar to that of many jewels. And so there's a poster here that these posters, all three of them come from Cornell University. And so they show the various gems, specific hummingbirds that are named after gems. And around them, I tell you what, I took a calendar when I was at Staples a month or so ago, and I knew I was having this topic. They had calendars on sale for whatever it was, $5 or something ridiculously cheap. And I bought a hummingbird calendar thinking, well, my wife can put it up. And then she came and said, you know what, you could use this for your topic. So I did. I cut it apart and pasted it on there. So that's where those come. And one, so anyway, a few from that calendar. But they show some of the variety. If you look at those pictures, I want to set these up afterward out here, and you can just marvel at some of those. I mean, the pictures are phenomenal. I told my wife, if I would have taken those pictures, I guess I'd probably be proud of them. But they're spectacular photos, some of them. And the picture and the colors, like in the tails, it's just incredible. So what is it about hummingbirds that fascinates us and attracts us with their beauty? Well, someone already pointed out the iridescent feathers with the colors of rainbow hue, and we'll want to jump into that a little bit. Maybe it's the male gorget. That's what they call the colorful part there beneath its throat, gorget, that has various. It gleams and shines depending on the light, and it actually seems to change colors. And maybe it's the spear-like bill. This one doesn't have a real long bill, but we'll look at some of those. Maybe it's the crests that adorn some of the hummers. They actually have a crest on their head, sort of like a little crown, a crown of jewels. God gave them their own little crown. And they flaunt those things, believe me. I don't really have any good pictures of one with a crown too much, but I did get some with tails, maybe the fancy tails, and some of these flaunt some pretty fancy tails. One source said, use these adjectives, splendid, spectacular, long and racket-shaped, streamers, rounded, forked, scissor-shaped, or pointed. There's two of them that I have here. Violet-tailed sylph, I like that one. I just love that purple tail. That is just astonishing. And then in the left, you have the long-tailed sylph. I'm sorry, you won't see these things around here. You'll have to go somewhere else, maybe Central or South America, to see this kind of a hummingbird. But they show you about the tails, at least, and what those look like. Maybe we should stop and consider this thought. When we see a hummingbird in this spectacular beauty, does it make us think of God? Does it remind us of the beauty that God has created and His heavenly beauty? And didn't God give beauty like this in some of His creatures to remind us of Him, to call our attention to Him? And that's why when I read these things in different books and different things, and they talk about how this evolved or that evolved, phenomenal things that couldn't have evolved by themselves, there's just something that goes inside me, because it can't be true, and it's avoiding God, which what God wants us to think about Him when we see these things. So I trust we can do that as we move on. Now, what is the science behind the iridescent feathers? That's what I'm hoping to look at now. This poster here on the there set up, I had to put it back for them. I'm sorry, you can't see it. I have a few that I cut out. I'm going to show them on the screen here in just a minute, but that poster shows some of the different scientific evidences of or aspects of the iridescent feathers that we're going to try to look at here. Someone has said the hummer's iridescent feathers are the most specialized of all bird feathers. Talk about superlatives. The most specialized, there you go, of all bird feathers. Hummingbird feathers are 5 times denser than those of other birds, and that contributes to the brilliant colors. And also, I didn't want to do that, I hit the wrong button. If you see here, it's only the top third or a quarter or so of the feathers that are actually iridescent. Below that, they're not, but it's these end of the feathers that are. Now, if you look right here, I don't even know if you can you see that in the back, this little feather right here? Right here where my pointer's going around? If you can't see it, that's all right. It says that's the actual size, and I don't know if it is up here, but it says that's the actual size of a ruby-throated gorget feather. So this is majorly magnified there for sure. Now, there's different ways to make color, right? You're probably all familiar with the word pigment. It doesn't have anything to do with hogs, right? It has to do with color. And so we have paints and things, and there are pigments. Did God paint the bird's feathers? He didn't. They're not painted. The hummingbird color is structural. I'm talking about the way it's built. And that's what we're going to look at here just right now. The way the hummingbird feather is structured, that's what makes the color. They're structured so that they reflect light in different angles And that's what makes these colors. So this poster is attempting to help us to understand that. Someone has said this is actually the nanoscopic level. Now, I'm not sure. Do you know how nanoscopic compares to microscopic? I'm not sure if I can say that. But we're talking at a very tiny level here. We're talking about these structures are so small in their nanoscopic is the term used. Now, what we have is we have on a feather. Keep hitting the wrong button here. In the feather, we're taking this barb here. That's this, magnified here. And then going out from the barb, you have the barbule. And this is a barbule cut out by itself. So the barbule is a small part of the feather. And here is a blow up of the cross section of the barbule. And in that barbule, there's a layer on top called keratin. And that serves to refract the light that hits it and directs it in. And then inside there, you have these melanosomes. You see these little structures in here where my pointer's showing there? Right here. Those are called melanosomes. One way to think of those is like they're a bubble. You ever blow bubbles in the sunshine and the bubbles start to show rainbow colors? Well, that's kind of what these melanosomes do. They are reflecting the light at different angles that causes it to show the different colors. Now, the barbules also act as mirrors. And so these barbules actually reflect, as you can see, the light coming down at different levels. And that's why this thickness of the barbule is important, because you see some reflects here at the first level, some reflects at the second, some reflects at the third, some reflects at the fourth. And depending at the angle that it reflects, you'll see red, orange, or yellow. And we'll see more about that in just a little bit. But so these are like mirrors too. They reflect this back. So we have two interplays of light here, refraction, bending light, and reflection, light bounces off. And so the reflection here, you see green in the back of a hummingbird, the iridescent green, like say in a ruby throat. And what that is the barbules of those feathers in the back, they're shaped like a concave mirror. And so they're dished in and they reflect light out in all directions. And so that shows the green colors. Now the gorget on a male hummingbird, the gorget, those barbules are like flat mirrors. And so they reflect light in only one direction. If the light hits here, it'll bounce off at the same angle. It won't bounce off at a different angle. With the curved mirrors, either way, it'll bounce off in all directions. But with the flat mirror, the angle it comes in at, it'll bounce off at that angle too. So the gorget barbules reflect light in only one direction. So the sun and the viewer, that determines what you're seeing there. That's one of the things. An interesting thing about this is if you have thinner melanosomes or thicker ones, see here, these are thinner ones and these are thicker ones. And so the thicker ones will reflect back longer wavelengths of light, which are the red and orange ones. The thinner ones, they reflect back the more blue or shorter wavelengths here when the melanosomes are thinner. So some of the hummingbirds here that are blue, you see the blue on them, that's because those melanosomes are thinner than the other ones. So basically, light refracts through the keratin like a prism when you refract the sunlight into the colors, and then it hits the top melanosome layer, some reflects, some goes through, hits the next melanosome, some reflects, some goes down, and reflects again. So what you have is a multifaceted kind of light coming at you that causes those shimmering and changing colors. And there you can see that where you have this color shifting feature. Viewing angle, there's two things. It's the viewing angle and the thickness or thinness of the melanosomes here. But you can see here how a person viewing it with the sun at the same angle, when the person is viewing it more directly, you're seeing orange. When the person is viewing it somewhere in the middle, you're seeing yellow. And when you're seeing it at a low angle, then you're seeing it in green. And so that's why, depending on the light, The hummingbird's gorgette can look black. It can look different colors too, but usually a hummingbird has more or less one primary color, like it's red or it's more purple or it's more pinky. This whole thing is extremely complex, one writer says. And he said that many colors produced by hummingbirds are based on a combination of peaks, one in the blue and one in UV or ultraviolet spectrum. And he said, that's something we can't understand. How can the same structure produce two peaks of different kinds? He said, I can't explain that. And he said, that amazes me. And yet he was an evolutionist. Well, I think understanding a little about the science, to me, enhances the beauty. But if you're like the person who took in the lecture about the stars and found it dry and boring, and who walked outside after the lecture and looked up in perfect silence at the stars and enjoyed that a whole lot more, that's all right too. You can look at hummingbirds and just enjoy them, and you don't have to worry your mind about how it makes that beauty. But to me, I think that enhances the beauty. If you say, that is really a neat and unique structure, the way God has created that structure in a hummingbird feather to create various colors that we see, and we say, wow. Quoting a little poem that was in several books, I think, from a man in the early 1800s about hummingbirds. He said, what heavenly tints and mingling radiance fly? Each rapid movement gives a different dye. Like scales of burnished gold, they dazzling show, now sink to shade, now like a furnace glow. All right, let's move to the next thing, which is location. Oops, I gave my answer away. I wanted to hold that just a little bit here. Where are hummingbirds found in the world? Or are they everywhere in the world? How many think they're everywhere in the world? How many think they're only some places in the world? Well, then where? We do have them in Pennsylvania, yay! Pennsylvania's in the Western Hemisphere, right? And so the hummingbirds are found only in the Western Hemisphere. Before the Europeans, I mean the Indians, okay, Native Americans, they lived here long before our people got here. And they knew all about hummingbirds, but the Europeans didn't know. When they came, they were like, this is, I can't even believe anything like this exists, because there weren't any over there. And there are none in Asia or Europe or Australia or Africa. Only the Western Hemisphere. That is North America, Central America, and South America, and some of the islands of Caribbean. And we were a little disappointed because we were going to Hawaii for our wedding anniversary, and we found out they have no hummingbirds there, none. And so it was interesting. Why that is, I don't totally know, except I guess it'd be too hard for a hummingbird to fly across the ocean. Can't fly quite that far. One Spaniard of the 1500s wrote that they are so hardy, yet so little, I would not dare to tell of it if others had not seen them also. So the Europeans had not known them, and he, in awesome wonder, dared to tell of it. Now they live, as far as the habitat, in the Western Hemisphere, they live about any kind of habitat. They live from the 15,000 foot elevation in the Andean peaks in South America, frozen, cold area, as well as to the humid tropical rainforest. And I brought this book along. My wife, she's collected a few, but this book is by Esther Quesada Terrell and her husband Robert Terrell. And these people, back in the 1980s, they decided, you know what, we just don't know much about hummingbirds. And they didn't mean just themselves, they meant everybody. Nobody knows what really to explain about a hummingbird. And so they decided, you know what, we're going to find out about hummingbirds. And so they started traveling, she and her husband, and they got special photographic equipment made back in the 80s. I mean, they were using film cameras. So if you're old enough like me to remember film cameras, that's what they were shooting with. And they found they couldn't get a flash fast enough to stop the wings. And so they found a man who built a stroboscopic flash for them. And it could, I forget what the detail is, but it's phenomenally fast. And these Terrells, They traveled like 80,000 miles looking after hummingbirds. They crawled around in the jungles and went all over the place. And I mean, they learned about hummingbirds. And when I went to turn to find out how something works in a hummingbird, I turned to their book because they explained the biology of it. They explained, they went into great detail, almost you'd think too great, but it was, that's an interesting book. I think they have two different books. This is maybe 85 copyright or something, but I think it's still a worthwhile book. We've learned maybe a few things since then, but it's still a very worthwhile book to look into. Now, so that's one thing, location. What about variety? How many different kinds of hummingbirds are there, do you think? Someone want to guess? Maybe someone knows. Anyone know the answer? I mean, other than my wife.
127.
Anyone else want to guess? Is he high or low? He's too low.
28.
Oh, you're just joking. Well, actually, they used to say over 300. You're safe to say over 300. Now, if you read books that are written maybe in the 90s or so, they'll say maybe 335 or something like that. Today, Cornell University says 360. I think they have a number maybe a little north of 360. And I have a copy at home that I downloaded of all the names of all the different hummingbirds, and I didn't go really read that over. But yeah, there's over 360. This is not superlative, like totally. There's one other bird species or family, shall we, a family is the right name, to the flycatchers, they say has 400, but the hummingbirds are second. So in all, even though they only live in the Western Hemisphere, the hummingbirds are second in that family of the most different kinds within that family. And that family is Trochilidae, and so on. I won't spend a lot of time with that. Are there more in North America or South America? South America is correct. There are many more species in South America than North America, as we'll look at here just shortly. How many of the 300, well, I should say this. I read that there's near the equator, like just north and south of the equator, there's 163 species. And Mexico has 51. How many of the 360 live in the U.S.? I mean, I'm talking about live and breed in the U.S. 8. If you go to Canada, they say there's only 4 there. So north is probably not better for hummingbird. South and warmer, that's better. So if you want to really see a lot of hummingbirds in the U.S., Arizona is a great place to go. That's probably the best place. There are some, and I'll talk about that more this afternoon. Sorry, I got some stuff to hold for this afternoon. And I'm telling you, the best is yet to come, so you just hang in there. It's more fun. But Arizona, you can see a lot of hummingbirds in there. That's a great place. But if you really want to see a lot of hummingbirds, you got to go to Costa Rica, Ecuador, and they have places where you can go and sit there, and they have feeders, and these hummingbirds come in, and it's like oohing and aahing. I mean, it's... I'm never there, but we have these dreams. So anyway, 8 major species plus 8 additional species that come into the U.S. Now, of the 8 species that breed in the United States, how many do we have in Pennsylvania? I'm talking about live and breed here. Well, that's a good guess. Yes. You're right. That's the picture that was on the current issue of Nature Friends, so I'm giving him a little shove here, too. But anyway, I asked Kevin about that one, and he sent it to me. It's probably just a screenshot, but it's still... I thought that was a beautiful picture of a ruby-throated hummingbird. I mean, we do have a beautiful and very special hummingbird that comes here to Pennsylvania. So you shouldn't feel slighted that we only have one, because we got one of the nicest ones, a ruby-throat. The only species to live and breed east of the Mississippi. Of course, now and then some unusual things happen, like I'm going to talk about this afternoon. My wife and I were talking the way up here, and she had gotten lists of all the hummingbirds she has seen so far, and she has 17 in her life list. You talked about life list. And so I thought 17 is not too bad. And I think of the 16 species that come here. In other words, there's maybe 8 more species that come into the U.S. but don't necessarily live and breed here permanently. she has seen maybe 12 of those. So that's because we were in Arizona a couple times. So that definitely helped a lot. And I have one that she didn't see, which I was lucky and was in Guatemala and saw a white-eared one. And now she doesn't have that one on her list, and she wasn't along with that trip. So, but she saw a few that I didn't see. Now, if you're living in Arizona or the West Coast, you might not see the ruby throat, but you'll see the other seven. And I think I have this list. Here's pictures of some of the ones that are in the United States. We have the Allens, the Annas, Black-chinned, Costas, Calliope, and Broad-tailed. So those are some of the nice, those are nice ones. Of course, we have the ruby throat, which is around here. And I have the Rufus. That's the eighth one. How many saw a Rufus already? Is that something you ever saw? I thought I had a list of all these. I wonder if I missed that slide. I think I must have missed that slide. Well, I think I'll move on from that. This is most of them then. Now, in the if you live in the Western Mountains, you won't see all of these. If you're on the West Coast, like Washington, or you know, you might see all seven of the other ones. But if you live in the mountains, you don't see all of these. The black chin. I keep hitting the wrong number button there. Black chin you would see in the mountains. Broad-tailed you'd see in the mountains. I'm talking about like the Rockies and so on. Calliope and our friend the Rufus. All right. I want to talk about size. So you're already seeing the answer here. But miniaturization. Miniaturization today is considered a premium. In computers, that's probably the best example. The phone in your hand probably has many times the computing power of a mainframe of yesterday that was the size of a whole building. And when they talk about putting millions or billions of transistors on a single chip, you think, wow. Smaller is better, no matter what some people like to say. But God is the source of miniaturization. God was doing it long before anybody else figured that out. We only copy some of the things that God did when we make things and we learn from Him. He showed us how in a hummingbird. All right, so what is the smallest hummingbird? Why, it's the bee hummingbird. And did you know that the bee hummingbird is also the smallest bird in the world? And here, it's actually a pretty creature, I would say. Blues. And this is a comparison I found comparing the bee hummingbird with a hand. So this is the actual, it's supposed to be the actual size compared to an actual hand here. So it would fit in your palm. And you might mistake it maybe for an insect of some kind if you didn't know better. where does the bee hummingbird live? In Cuba. Lives in Cuba. And it takes the crown of the smallest. It's just about 2 1/4 inches long. Weighs less than the penny. 1.8 grams. I think a penny might be 2 grams. And you know, of the body, how much of that is beak and tail? 2 1/4 inches and you got a beak and a tail yet. Now when the Tyrells saw it, they had to go hunting for this thing in Cuba. I guess today, I mean, there's pictures out there, so people must go find them. But they went storming around in Cuba looking for this bird. And they thought it was an insect at first. And they were crawling around in this crocodile swamp, and they found this bee hummingbird that they were looking for. And that night, the story says that they celebrated by having sauteed tomatoes with crocodile. Pretty good celebration, don't you think? I don't believe the cooks would be serving us that today, you think? But anyway. And yet they watched this infinitesimal bird scare away a vulture. The vulture wanted to sit on the perch on their nesting tree, and this little critter went after it. And I guess it didn't like the hassle and decided to easier to perch somewhere else. It left. So that's kind of interesting that there's that much boldness in this little thing. It might be called arrogance, perhaps. But now we have the largest one, and I don't have a picture of it on my. We just got this bird, this book from our neighbors, the Whitmers, and that's the giant hummingbird. And this is a picture of the giant hummingbird. It's about 7 to 8 inches long. So this is the biggest one. And it weighs 18 and a half to 20 grams. Most of your hummingbirds are weighing 3 or 4 grams. So this thing is like mega. I mean, this is a big boy. He's 4 or 5 times the others. And this looks a very interesting book, Hummingbirds, A Life-Size Guide to Every Species. The picture is supposed to be life-size, actual, and they have 330-some, whatever it is, species in here, not all pictured. A very interesting book. Well, the smallest in the United States is a calliope, and that's a very pretty bird, too. That weighs in at 2.5 grams, and an interesting thing about these is you see these feathers here and it's gorget. These actually can lift up and like they can go straight out. And I saw a picture, but I don't have it of that hummer flying with those sticking straight out. It looks almost dangerous, but it's not. It's just for display. It's like hummers, they're built to impress. And so they can really do things that are pretty amazing. Size. An entire hummingbird, I saw this, weighs less than a single bald eagle primary feather. The bald eagle primary feather weighs about 4 grams, and that's as much as the whole hummingbird weighs. Hummingbird eggs are small too. And again, Kevin Shank had sent me some pictures of, he said he's got lots of pictures of hummingbird nests, that's amazing. But anyway, these eggs that are in here in this hummingbird nest, if you want to study an art, study the art of hummingbird nest building. And I don't have time to really talk about that, but it's an amazing thing how they build their nests with spider silk and so on. It's just really incredible. And these eggs, they say, are half the size of a jelly bean. So that maybe gives you some idea. We can ask them to serve us jelly beans for lunch or something. I don't know if they provided that or not. But anyway, half the size of a jelly bean, the hummingbird egg. And the chicks are smaller than a bumblebee when they hatch, and they're naked and blind. They're not they're not precocious chicks. They have to be, the mother bird has to sit on them and keep them warm and feed them. And that's an amazing thing too. You see her feeding it there. I mean, talk about getting fed children. Mom is shoving that down their throat. So how you like that? I don't like peas. Your mom got out a straw or something and said, here you go, down your throat it goes. It wouldn't like that too well, but that's the only way these birds can stay alive. The mama has to feed them by taking her beak and putting something, kind of essentially throwing up down the baby bird's throat and say, here's the nectar for you today. Well, anyway. Now, I don't actually think that this physical size is the most impressive thing about a hummingbird's size. I think the most impressive thing is what God can do inside that bird. And it's just incredible. The more I study, it's like, wow, this is just amazing. This is the true superlative. All right, let's talk about flight. And hummingbirds, a few quotes here, the undisputed champions of the sky with their skillful and daring flight. Another, no bird has more mastery in flight than a hummingbird. It can perform stunning flight maneuvers that other bird species can only dream about. Hummers can fly forward, backward, left, right, and upside down, and they can hover. And Mrs. Tyrell says, if the Olympics were held for birds, the hummingbird would take all the medals. Now, there's only one medal that it wouldn't take. You know what that one is? The hummingbird can't do this. It can't soar. So some birds can do something a hummingbird can't. It can't just glide out there. The wings aren't created for that. But anyway, the hummingbirds can fly 20 to 30 miles per hour. It varies somewhat. But when they do their dives, some people call them courtship dives, but some scientists don't agree with that. That really is courtship. They just, mostly are being hummingbirds, a little aggressive, a lot aggressive, really. And so how many of you saw the hummingbird doing its arc? You ever observe that? Okay, a number of people have. It's fun to watch. They can do sometimes a little arc, right in the backyard, you see the little arc, or sometimes they do a big arc, And so when they go the whole way to the top and then they come diving down like that up to the treetops and come down, they can go 60 mile an hour. Not usually, but I mean 40 to 60 mile per hour in those dives. And the wings flap up to 80 times a second in normal flight. I didn't say minute, I said second. 80 times a second in typical flight, and again up to 200 times when they're doing that, you know, dive type of thing. And of course, the wings flapping is what gives them their name, right? You hear them, they go, you know, they're buzzing because the wings are flapping and making that noise. Now, we'll look at design for flight. The hummingbird wing structure, this isn't a real great slide, but anyway, they have specialized structures that enable these superlative flights. And one is the wing. The wing is capable of turning in any direction, forward, backward, up, down. It has motion, and that's because of the way these wing bones are designed inside. Now the typical bird, this is the typical bird wing, which is very like an arm. So you have your shoulder and the upper part of your arm, and then you have the lower part of your arm, and you have a hand. But a hummingbird wing is almost all hand. You see that? It's mostly hand. And at the shoulder, this shoulder can enable it to rotate almost 180 degrees. And so it has a lot of mobility at the shoulder. And of course, some of us humans, we get, after a while, the shoulders have to get repaired. But God has created a hummingbird shoulder that wing can go up and down 80 times a second, and it can reverse direction. It is just incredible. Nearly all hand. So the wings can actually make almost a horizontal circle around above its body if it needs to. So let's think about some other things related to, and that's how God has created the muscles for this creature to fly. Birds have two muscles that move the wings up and down. Here's one. And here's one. You see the one's little and the other's big. Okay? So when a regular bird flies, it flaps. That is, it pushes the wings down, and that's what creates the lift for it. And the small muscle, the big muscle does that. That's what makes the bird flap down. But when it brings the wings back up, it uses a small muscle. So it's not creating lift when it raises the wing. It's creating lift when it goes down. But when you look at a hummingbird, you see that these muscles are much closer in size. They're both big muscles. And so when a hummingbird flies, it can create lift down and up, flaps down and up, both ways. And so that's an impressive aspect of its size. Is it designed that way, would you say? Would you say that's designed? It's created that way. It also has large muscles. Here, I have this here. Talk about big muscles. These chest muscles here are making up nearly one-third of its weight. So if you had biceps and muscles like that, you'd be one of those big weightlifters and bodybuilders, right? And you probably still wouldn't be one-third of your body weight. So these hummingbirds, oh, I wanted to say this too. This other side, I almost forgot. The large keel bone. If you get these big muscles, you have to have an anchor for them, right? Muscles don't work unless they can contract. They got to get shorter to do their work. And so to do that, you have to hook the muscle on up top here and here and again. Now, of course, in your hand, that's a unique structure there. I can't talk about a hand right now. But the hummingbird has this very large keel bone, larger than other birds. And the reason it needs such a large keel bone, it's like a breastbone. We have a breastbone. Sorry. But okay. Still hear me? But the hummingbird can't really have a breastbone, but it has this keel bone to anchor these muscles on, and that's what enables those big muscles to function properly. Now, they create lift, as I said, in both ways. It is sometimes said that the hummingbird can flap in a figure eight pattern. It goes here and comes back and around a figure eight pattern. I went the wrong way, I guess, like this. And another diagram shows these, they make these air currents, spiraling air currents, and they're also going like this. And so someone has said that these hummingbirds are actually riding on like a little tornado. They create their own little tornado of air currents that create lift for them. We think of lift in terms of like an airplane, but the hummingbird creates its own lift. They're surfing on air, one man wrote. Design differences. Design for flight, hovering. Not ready for that. I guess I didn't have a slide on this one particularly. It looks like this is taking too long. I think we'll leave that. Let's talk about migration. That's my next slide anyway. Ruby-throated hummingbirds, some of them anyway, they come down here to Texas. These are various patterns of other birds as well. But one of these pads is for a ruby-throated hummingbird, and they can actually take off in Texas and fly 500 miles across the Gulf of Mexico to the Yucatan in Mexico without stopping. The ruby-throated hummingbird might fly to Central or South America, 20 miles a day, and then come back in the spring. It's a really interesting thing. How do they know where to go? I'll say a little more about that in this afternoon's topic. But here's an interesting thought about the migration. When they need to fly across the Gulf of Mexico like this, they have to build up fat in their bodies, and they can build up 40 to 50% more weight. Now think, if you suddenly got half another time heavier, you'd be a lot fatter. So this is a dilemma for the hummer. In other words, if you get too fat, you're not going to be able to get your weight across the Gulf of Mexico. But if you don't have enough fat, you're going to run out of energy before you get to the other side, and you're going to fall into the ocean. God has designed them that they build up that fat, fly across the Gulf of Mexico, and then they fly back again. Now, not all ruby-throats do that. Some fly around. There's different ways they go, but some fly across the Gulf of Mexico. Well, I want to talk about the energy package just a little bit. It takes a lot of energy. 2 to 3 gram birds with this energy. How did they get enough energy? Well, the answer is to eat, and eat some more. 4 times eat. Oh, I'm sorry, you're all getting hungry now. I want to go eat, but anyway, thankfully we're not quite like hummingbirds. And while you're at it, you can have all the sugar you want. In fact, you eat mostly sugar. Nectar, mostly sugar. How much do hummers eat? Sometimes more than half their weight in a day, or 8 times their weight in water. Maybe I'll just quote this. This was in the Rod and Staff Birds of the World series. They said a 170-pound person would need to eat, you ready? How many pounds of hamburger to eat as much as a hummingbird? The answer is 285 pounds. I mean, that's a big hamburger. I don't care what those Texans have. They don't have a hamburger that big. 285 pounds or 340 pounds of potatoes in one day to equal the hummingbird's consumption, it said. So I didn't go verify that, so maybe Dana wants to do that. But what do they eat? Well, I already said nectar. And don't they need protein too? Do hummingbirds eat anything beside nectar? That's right. You got the answer. They also eat little bugs. Some of the bugs are down inside the flowers, and some of that actually can aid in pollination. There's interesting things about that. But they eat tiny insects. And it's been shown that hummers can actually pick insects out of the air with their bills. Do hummers need to eat 3 times a day? So you have breakfast and lunch and supper. Well, they often come more in the morning and the evening, but one source says a hummer spends most of its waking hours eating and that it might visit more than 1,000 fuchsia blossoms in one day. Structures for eating, this is phenomenal too. The bill. Here's some different things about the bill. And here's our champion, the sword-billed hummingbird, has like a 4-inch bill. And you think, wouldn't that be a hindrance to have a 4-inch bill? Well, the kind of flowers that it goes to are deep. It needs the 4-inch bill to get that deep, to get the nectar at the bottom. I'd love to see one. That's a really neat hummingbird. The other thing do you think that the hummingbirds suck the nectar out of the flower? That's what people thought for a long time, but that has been shown not to be true. The hummingbird does not suck the nectar. It's not like a straw. It uses its tongue. Don't take any lessons here, children. But it can stick its tongue out a long way. And even that, well, maybe say this before I talk about that. But the tongue has these specialized structures, grooves on the side of its tongue. And when it puts its tongue down in there, those grooves fill with nectar. Then it retrieves the tongue back into its mouth, and then it kind of squeezes that those grooves, and that nectar then flows down into its gullet. But to work a long tongue like that, this was, I thought it was fascinating. The hummingbird needs a special structure here called the hyoid apparatus to make that tongue go in and out. And that thing wraps around its skull, hooked to the tongue, and wraps around its skull and fastens on back here, and that's what pulls that tongue back in again. Isn't that just incredible? That the little, I mean, to make the tongue work. Well, yeah, all these things are so neat. I should quote this about the bill. It says, "The bill is the perfect apparatus for extracting nectar and snapping up insects, both." All right. We're talking about superlatives, a super efficient digestive system. If it has to eat so much, it has to have a way to process that. And so they can, it says most of the liquid passes through them in about 20 minutes. And the secret is that the hummingbird does not, I was reading this article and I don't have really that incorporated in my notes about from Johns Hopkins, and they were saying, well, how comes it that the hummingbird can have such a high percentage of sugar and it doesn't hurt it? The hummingbird, they say, doesn't get diabetes. It doesn't, you know, have problems because of the sugar level. How does it do that? And one of the things they did was they tried to sequence the genome of these hummingbird livers to say, how does it change it into fat and not uptake the sugar into the cells, but rather burns it? And it's because it's missing a certain protein that would normally code for the bringing the sugar into the cell and storing it there. And I thought, wow, that's an incredible little phenomenon right there. And the whole thing, I was just reading it this morning again, going over it, and they kept saying how this evolved, this thing. And they're thinking they can learn maybe how to help humans with diabetes if they keep investigating this hummingbird and how that takes that sugar out of there. Well, that's great if they can do that, but let's give the glory to God. The heart, it has the largest heart in proportion to its body, and the heart can beat up to 1,200 times a minute. I mean, again, that's superlative. 1,200, your heart, I mean, if you're going 180, your heart is, you're about maxed out. If you're going 200, you're probably having some problem with your heart. I mean, but 1,200 times a minute, so that little heart is really cranking. And even the oxygen delivery system. How do you move enough oxygen to burn that sugar up to create the energy? I mean, you've got to burn the energy. It won't do any good if you can't burn it. So they need all this oxygen. And the lungs are small, of course, but I read an interesting thing. They said that around the lungs, there's these air sacs that are designed to hold more oxygen. So it has little tanks, you might say, of extra oxygen there. Well, there's more that could be said. I think we're going to not talk about torpor. Maybe I'll say about that later. But Mr. Hummer can sort of tank up and store sugar as fat. Well, I think I'll just bring that to a close here. I have an assembly with some pictures here. The earth is full of thy riches. I hope we saw a little bit of that this morning as we talked about the hummingbirds. And the one thing I'd like to leave with us is, if any of these things that I talked about were not present or didn't function, could that hummingbird exist? What's the logical answer? It needs all of it or none of it. Like, it's an all or none thing. It will work or it won't work. You've got to have a package here. It's a deal. You've got to have a package deal to make this hummingbird fly and do the things it can do, or it won't be able to. It'll die. And so God has designed and created this hummingbird for the things that we just talked about. Oh, sorry. Questions or anything you'd like to say?